Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. Today, I will share with you a tip regarding how we cross personal boundaries under the name of kindness. And I had an amazing conversation with Dr. Sister Jenna, the host of the America Meditating Radio, about changing negative thoughts. Then, Dr. Joe Luciani, a clinical psychologist for 40 years and internationally best-selling author of the self-coaching series of books, will share his wisdom with us from his latest book, Unlearning Anxiety and Depression, the 4-step self-coaching program to reclaim your life. So I'm going to really quickly get into the tip of the week. This week, I have been observing and working with boundaries and relationships. It begins with how our parents do not create boundaries for, you know, our children, us as children. Don't ask us children to uphold boundaries. Many parents cross boundaries with their children by having their children sleep in their parents' bed for many, many years beyond necessary. They may not knock when they're going into children's rooms, and therefore their children do not learn to knock when they are coming to their parents' room. They can cross boundaries by negating their children's thought process, talking or directing in a hostile or aggressive manner. So if their child says something that's like, that's stupid, you shouldn't be able to do that. Or checking in their teen's room when they're not in the room is crossing a boundary. Teens taking money from their parents' room is crossing boundaries. I also have been working with couples who cross boundaries by checking each other's cell phone, computer, social media, text, pants, pockets, purses, and other stuff, right? Others share their most personal experiences that they have there in their home with their friends or strangers or even in social media without getting their mate's permission. Others cross boundaries by making major decisions about life and implementing it without sharing with their mate, even financial decisions. Among friends, under the name of caring, I've been witnessing boundaries being crossed by telling a friend what to do and then get angry at them when the friend does not comply and then gossip about them to another friend. In companies, boundaries are constantly broken by asking employees to do things that are not part of their job description or create relationships beyond coworker or boss and employee. In these times, boundaries are being constantly crossed when without a mask, people are moving toward each other's spaces and refuse or fight store managers to let them in. Some people even think that it's crossing their boundaries when they're being asked to wear one. So define your boundaries, spatial beliefs, emotional or physical boundaries, and communicate them to people around you. Let them know respectfully if they're crossing your boundaries and how it has affected you. Be aware of other people's boundaries. If you don't know what they are, ask. If you've crossed someone's boundaries without knowing, apologize and promise not to cross it again. So it's important for everyone to have a clear boundaries and share it with others. This habit creates much healthier relationships and much less drama within relationships, I promise you. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Sister Jenna.
Hello, listeners. This is Christopher from The Christopher Show. Hey, if you missed one of our shows here at KMET, don't worry about it. You can go to our webpage, and that's KMET1490AM.com. Go to the homepage, click on the SoundCloud tab, and hear any show anytime you want.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I'm so excited to have Sister Dr. Jenna with us. She is the founder of Brahma Kumaris, a meditation museum, and she is the host of America Meditating. And I'm excited to have her to teach us meditation, because we all need to meditate, not only right now, always, but really right now. So thank you for being with us.
Glad to be back with you. One of the things about meditation that I think is really important is that we must understand that thought has power. And when we recognize that our thoughts have power, we will use our thoughts in a very useful way. Example, ask the self right now, are my thoughts driven by my past or are my thoughts driven by my future? And which one tends to be more? Are my thoughts from the past more, or is my vision or my future in my thinking more? Like when you're planning something ahead, you have a lot of thoughts that are programmed for that ahead, so to speak. But if your thoughts are feeling or getting some sort of an influence from your past where you feel, I failed so many times, I'm never going to make this happen again, why do I bother, but you still try, the thought of you feeling that you're a failure will actually create more obstacles in your pushing forward. So maybe in this meditation, it might be nice for us to kind of pause for a little and deeply say to the self that I accept and I know and I accept and I believe that these thoughts that I have are crucial towards my well-being. And then I need to maybe identify the power of thought and how thought can co-create again my future, and that I want to focus just on that. So we can try that one for a minute or two.
Love to. Okay, ready?
Yes, I'm ready. Firstly, I'd like you to practice this one with meditating with your eyes opened, as if you're daydreaming a little. And I'm not looking at you. I'm just, most of the times we're walking around with our eyes open. So with your eyes opened, I want you to simply become aware that there's an energy behind your eyes. It is you, the living being, the living energy, consciousness, the soul. Just imagine for a little that the spirit is behind your eyes, that which feels, thinks, chooses. The energy behind your eyes carries your stories and will decide if it wishes to let go of some of the stories it's been carrying. The energy behind your eyes, the soul, will determine how you manage the coronavirus crisis, or if you choose to be afraid and worry about the future. So imagine the energy of thought is very powerful. And what do you think will happen if you think in a state of worry and fear about the present environment in the world where your future is concerned? Give that a thought. That thought will create an energy that will bring worry and fear into your future. Your eyes are still opened and you're thinking. You're using thoughts behind your eyes. Now, what if you choose to look at the coronavirus as an opportunity for you to get to know yourself better? To be more introspective? To try to decode if the thoughts that flow through your mind on a day-to-day basis, if they have merit or purpose or meaning to you. It's meditation. It's like you're taking time to pay attention to the world behind your eyes. There's nothing wrong with that. So let's choose the thought of seeing the coronavirus time and crisis as a moment. So now I'd like you to actually look at this particular time of the coronavirus and ask, have I been taking care of myself inside of me? Is there the virus of anger, greed, attachment, or fear? They're all thoughts. And you look back at your life and see, what have you been doing with your thought energy up until this moment? What has it served? Be honest with yourself. That's how you'll be set free. Take a few moments and ponder on that. And even after this meditation, grab a sheet of paper and write down how you feel you've been taking care of you internally over these years. Because the reality is, the natural nature of you, the living being, is an energy of great potential and power and truth. And the vaccine for the virus is the thought practice of power, truth, compassion, peace. How we can choose to approach the future of this particular time is to make a commitment of taking a daily dose of being truthful to the self, being powerful to the self, being peaceful with the self. It's like the vaccine for the virus of anger, or greed, or ego. So how you can approach the post-corona crisis. I just mentioned the Hindi word of corona, but the corona crisis is to start to serve yourself deep inside with these quality of thoughts so that we can start to feel the wonder instead of the fear. So I'll just give you a little sample again. With your eyes still open, imagine for a little bit. The world has all this anxiety about the virus. And instead of identifying with it all, you turn inwards and you ask, is there even a virus in me of anger or jealousy or fear? Because I don't want that in me. And you decide to take the vaccine of replacing your anger with peace, replacing your fear with love, replacing the ego with truth, wisdom, self-respect. That's your vaccine. So let the world do what it needs to do. But don't forget your world and what you need to do for it. Are you willing to protect yourself from picking up any further viruses? And are you willing to become a healer someone who walks with the right vaccine in you, generating that energy around you. So choose to respond to the future with these ideas and thoughts, and it will just feel a whole lot more normal or natural for you. This will be your new norm, to always have the cure, to feel the way you want to feel, not the way the world tends to influence its emotions and feelings onto you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sister Dr. Jenna, for another one of beautiful meditation. I just feel so calm listening to you and recognizing what parts of me were coming out, where there were anger or fear, and kind of getting released and coming back really like a white light of feeling my vibrations are getting higher and higher. So thank you for that. And for everyone, stay tuned for more meditation with Sister Dr. Jenna. Thank you.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I am excited to have Dr. Joe Luciani, who has been practicing clinical psychology for more than 40 years. He's the internationally best-selling author of the self-coaching series of books, and now published in 10 languages. And his latest book is Unlearning Anxiety and Depression, the 4-step self-coaching program to reclaim your life. He appears frequently on national television, radio, and online, and has been featured in numerous national media sites. And I'm glad to have you with me today, Dr. Luciano. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. We're experiencing 104 degrees outside, but other than that, I'm doing well. Thank you for asking.
Where are you?
New Jersey.
Oh, New Jersey, from the other side of the coast. So how are you guys doing with the COVID?
Oh, we're doing really well. Today was the very first day we had zero, or yesterday was, that was the stat from the New York Times, zero new cases. And our death rate is down below, I believe, 40. So that's really the best since March for us. So
yes.
Very enthusiastic. Yeah.
Not for us. California is rising every day. We got too many people who love to go out to the beaches and party. So we might go back into our homes for a while again. But I see my clients, you know, with a mask, and we all sit there working together that way. So far, so good. But it's, I think we need to be a little bit more responsible, all of us, to and do this for ourselves and our family members and the community, so we can bring all of this out.
Yeah. Let me ask you. I do all remote sessions at this point with masks, and you can't see all those facial expressions. How much of a deficit do you feel that is?
Inside the room.
Yeah, when you can't see someone's face when you're working with them in therapy.
I think that at this point, there's a distinction between when I do online sessions, because I do 3 days of online sessions. I can see everybody's facial language, but there's this energy that is among us that's missing. So in the office, I don't get to see this part of, you know, I see their eyes. So there's a lot with hand movement, body movement, and eyes that comes through. I just don't see this piece. But I do get the energy that, you know, that is in the room, the feeling that goes back and forth in the room.
That's good.
So obviously the best scenario would be for us to be in the same room without any mask. But I guess each one of them takes away something, but gives us another thing.
Yeah, I'll be moving in that direction shortly. So I was just curious.
Yeah, the rest of the body language is there. You just don't have the mouthpiece pretty much, but your eyes shine or sadness comes through, the rage goes through, and then the body language and hand movement all is there.
Yeah, my doctoral dissertation was on facial expressions and making a test to assess facial expressions. So I'm hypercritical of looking at someone's emotions and trying to see what's coming through other than what they're saying.
Absolutely. I want to talk about your book. And, you know, as I was going through it, I kept looking at different aspects of about your book that I wanted to share with our audience. So one of the first things that came up for me, it was that you look at the emotional struggle that we all go through, and you call it a swamp. And then you said that insecurities fuel all of the emotional struggles. And then you defined insecurity as a feeling of vulnerability, helplessness, resulting from, you know, our childhood psychological wounds, some of it real, some of it imagined, and a kind of like faulty perception that you can't handle life or some aspects of it. And emotional distortions that are not necessarily facts, but, you know, we hold them on as if they're facts. And some of it becomes even a habitual thinking and perceiving, and minimizing the accurate way that we can perceive things. And then you talk about how these types of insecurities create so much of our struggle. Can you share with us and our audience about how you are defining all of it through insecurity?
Well, the best way is to look at insecurity as the motor. So those early feelings of vulnerability, you know, no one has perfect parents. Everyone experiences loss, separation, illness. So we all have some insecurity. So it depends on how much insecurity, and that comes from your developmental years. Now, what insecurity does as the motor, it kind of gets us to want to compensate for vulnerability. Human beings hate being out of control, let's face it. We loathe it. I tend to think the loss of control is probably one of our basic DNA instincts that have protected us up until this point in our species. Now, when we feel a loss of control, we try to compensate. And that's where you start to develop the underlying or underpinnings of anxiety and depression. We compensate by maybe worrying, you know, what if this happens? What if that happens? By avoiding, by pulling back and avoiding certain circumstances in life. There are many ways that we tend to compensate our insecurities. And that creates an unnatural kind of expression, because we're really figuring out cognitively how to, what's coming. We're thinking, we're stressing. It's not natural. So I call that a control juggle. So as we grow and mature, we tend to accumulate strategies of control. And these strategies, like a juggler, we juggle, but eventually lactic acid, only in this case, psychological lactic acid builds up. And that, when that juggle falters, when those balls start to fall down, that's the onset of where anxiety and depression can creep in.
And you also talk about this juggle turning into a habitual loop that we create, in a sense, you know, some form about anxiety and some form about the depression, which gets us continuously into this loop. And then as we take some information from outside, we go right back into those loops. Can you share a little bit about these types of habitual loops?
Yeah. Well, we are creatures of habit. Habits make us efficient. Otherwise, you'd have to learn every morning to retie your shoe or button your shirt or blouse. So we do prefer habits. Now, habits are learned. And I have a rather heretical view that anxiety and depression are, in fact, habits of insecurity. Now, I'm talking about mild to moderate depression and anxiety are habits. Now, habits are either reinforced and then they will continue, or they are broken, not fed. How do we feed anxiety and depression? Well, we feed them with crumbs of doubt, fear, and negativity. If we incessantly keep those thoughts coming, the doubts, the fears, we are reinforcing the muscle of that insecurity rather than challenging it. So we wind up creating, not only creating the habit, but reinforcing it. And these are called habit loops. They're actually anatomically in our brain. Our brain structures these loops in such a way that they will go on for as long as we are reinforcing them. And with unlearning, I feel that it suggests that we've learned anxiety and depression, and that's where the title of the book comes then, to unlearn these. We have to learn to neutralize the habit, identify it, of course, neutralize it, and then to reinforce a more adaptive habit to replace that destructive habit.
You also talk about neuroses, like the confusion of the past and the present. Can you say a little bit about that? Because you talk about the inner and outer, the inner and outer expression of control, which the inner strategies of control you call occurring in our mind, such as anticipation, hostility, lying, avoidance, guilt, manipulation, rationalization, procrastination, so on. And then you also talk about the most important one, which is worrying. And then the outer strategies that are involved, compulsive behaviors, come in different ways and varieties, in gambling, hoarding, in type of addiction, sex, overeating, nail biting, pulling out hair, cleaning too much, or any of those addictions. And you say that by itself, any of those type of control creates the stress that it's behind the anxiety and the depression. So there's a stress, there's a worry, and then we try to overcompensate by controlling and over-controlling, and that type of over-controlling takes on the concept of the anxiety and the depression. And then you also talked about the neurosis bearing in the past and the present together. Can you share a little bit about what I just said, all the pieces I said about your book?
Well, certainly we have all of those. There was a study done, I think his name was Penfield in Canada, in the 60s or 70s. He was doing neurosurgery, and the patient was on local anesthesia. And of course, the brain not having nerve endings, they were able to operate as he was conscious. And they hit a certain point in that brain that bring out, that person had a visual image of something that had transpired as a child, the sounds, the smells, the hallucinatory effect of that, which was remarkable, because now we know there are these memories contained in the brain. But what was interesting about the study is that he went on to do other things in the brain, came back to that spot, hit that exact same spot, and again, the exact same image came forward. So we have within us those images and influences of the past. And if they are negative influences, of course, for example, I'm working with a man whose father was very, very abusive. And he developed this strategy of becoming a pleaser. He really was so leery of his father's abuse that he would just figure out, constantly think about how I can make him happy, et cetera, et cetera. So now in the present, of course, we see that he just loathes the fact that he can't say no to somebody. He has to please everybody. So we see where the contamination of that past reflex really does infiltrate our present, and it infiltrates it not necessarily in a conscious way. We can become conscious of these reflexes. They're a bit less than conscious. Not necessarily unconscious, they can be, but they are retrievable. And this is what therapy and analysis has always been about, retrieving these connections to the past. And it is so important, because when we are allowing the past to contaminate our present, we're not totally in control of what we're doing, where we're going, how we're feeling. We're being kind of cannibalized by old, especially old destructive thoughts, habits, experiences. So it's important to extricate ourselves from those things in us that are what I call kind of like a knee-jerk reflex. I call it the child reflex, because these are very primitive. Take, for example, the next time you worry or fear something, you could almost hear yourself sounding like a child to yourself. Oh, no, I'm not going to be able to stand that. It's good. You see that child come out in these emotions. That's the child reflex, and that's certainly something that drives a lot of anxiety and depression.
Yes, and it seems like a lot of the past jumps into the future in order to create that type of a worry. So we recreate also not the past, not only the past and the present, but also recreate it in the future, and then we get scared of it in the present.
The future, of course, doesn't exist. Right. So anytime we project our insecurity forward, we are now creating monsters that, as Mark Twain said, I've worried about many things in my life, most of which have never happened. You know, so we are preparing. When we worry about something terrible that may happen in the future, our body, our physiology is reacting as if it's true, as if it's happening now. For example, the person that says, oh, I don't want to go to the dentist, they're going to pull my tooth, it's going to be so terrible. Well, those thoughts alone are starting to put you into a stress mode, an anxiety mode, adrenaline starting to course through your body and cortisol. So we are reacting as if that future event were happening right now. So it's very important to realize when you project your insecurity forward, your body doesn't differentiate whether it's a real or imagined danger. Your body reacts as if it's true. So you are stressing yourself. And the way I look at stress, this is most important for me. I think of a bucket, and the bucket is filled with the balancing neurotransmitters, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin. We need those to stay balanced. Insecurity pokes holes in the bottom of that bucket, and the neurotransmitters drip out. We create imbalances. So stress is what pokes more holes in that bucket. So the more stress, the more you deplete, the more imbalanced you become. This is why medication works. Medication slows down that absorption so we can maintain what we once were able to do naturally. Now we can do it artificially through medication.
And then it would be really great if we also shifted the habitual loops that we can also learn how to balance those chemicals in our own brain without, like, the medication tries to hold it, and then we still have the same loops that makes it imbalanced. Before we go to your step-by-step mind talk and the four-step coaching that you have, if we bring all the conversations you're having to the here and now conversations we have, the stress that we hold about the COVID, not knowing all the changes, we're just talking about the changes we have to face when it comes to therapy and our clients, and, you know, the sense of responsibility that I would have, like the minute somebody leaves the office, I'm putting Lysol everywhere, and I'm putting, you know, hydrogen peroxide with water everywhere, wiping everything. And then my own skin doesn't like it, so then I get bumps because all these chemicals now are in the air. But I'm trying to really clean everything and make sure that everyone is safe who's coming there, including myself, including my family, and all of that. And then, like, even when you're trying to be the essential worker and help and support and be there with everyone and, you know, maintain some sort of a life, because we have no idea how this thing is going to turn out and what it would be. And this uncertainty of the future that is showing up adds to that type of a stress and anxiety. And then I hear from my clients that each one, depending on if somebody has lost their job or not, they have a different type of an issue. If they were people who are very wealthy, but the whole business has shut down, and they really, nobody ever realized that, you know, everything can be taken away in a split second and you have no idea what's going to happen. If people who have kids at home, they're not teachers. They don't know how to teach their kids and have to sit there with an education system. Or even if they think they have to, you know, send back their kids, you're like, how am I going to do this? Like, take them 2 hours in the morning, come back and take the other one 2 hours. Like, I have to work. How can I even, you know, shift my work to being a driver going back and forth? There is so many differences that we have to adjust to, and still not even know if whatever we're adjusting to, it's a short-term or a long-term concept. So the stress is sky high. So when we're talking about the struggle, everything we just talked about, how do you relate it? How do you see that with what's going on right now with all the stress that's going on?
Well, I think we need to recognize that circumstantial stress, like the virus, or like a soldier in war, there is a normal amount of fear and anxiety and worry. What we really need to be concerned with is you're not going to eliminate all the concerns and fears that you have right now with this virus. It's understandable. It's natural. It's protective. It's what human beings do to stay safe. It's why we put on seatbelts and take vitamins. We're trying to protect ourselves. What is important is for everyone to realize the difference between normal circumstantial stress and anxiety and excessive stress and anxiety perpetrated by insecurity. Typically, that means that we will leave the present and project ourselves into that uncertain future. I'm going to catch it. I'm going to get this. This will never stop. My job will never come back. When we start to project insecurity into the picture, now we're piling on. We've got the circumstantial stress that's already there. Once we get into the excessive, disproportionate stress, now we're putting ourselves in such a stress pressure cooker that we are now becoming susceptible to anxiety and depression. Now, there may be some moderate moodiness or anxieties, but not the same as more clinical anxiety and depression. With excessive stress that does not relent over time, that bucket with the holes in it, you're going to wind up actually creating chemical imbalances. So it's the excessive stress that we can do something about.
Dr. Luciani, this is what my experience has been. At the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, I used to see a lot of anxiety, even turning it almost into OCD. Now I'm experiencing a lot more depression from people because they've already worked through some of the unknownness or uncertainty, or they just figured, okay, it's just going to be uncertain. At least they got used to the uncertainty, which, you know, at the beginning it was like, oh, we can't have uncertainty. I have to be in control. And at one point it's like, might as well just can't control it. Nobody can control it. Nobody in the world can control it. Okay, then I can be okay, or at least it is what it is with the uncontrollable. Now people are sharing a lot of depression. Status quo, maybe even facing the powerlessness or the hopelessness, or defining the purpose of life. And there's a lot more existential conversations that are coming up. What is your experience at this point?
Very similar. I call it COVID fatigue. Mm-hmm. I think that we have a tolerance. The anxiety that started all of this and has lived with us has created this fatigue that I think eventually it just overwhelms us. I think of it like a circuit breaker in a house. We start out with this anxiety, and the anxiety keeps growing, and we keep putting in larger circuit breakers to handle the anxiety and larger circuit breakers. But eventually, you're going to get to a point where the house is going to burn down. And I think with the chronic fatigue, mental fatigue that comes with stressing over this virus, something in us needs to shut down. We turn that breaker off, and we tend to kind of pull back and try to insulate ourselves from the life stressors, but also in a sense from our own psychology, which torments us if we just let it go awry. So we tend, maybe it's adaptive, you know, maybe some form of this depressiveness. Now, I'm not saying depression, but depression in the sense of shutting down and pulling back is a way to protect us from the over extreme of anxiety and hysteria that might go on if not. But I do think that you're absolutely correct that we're starting to see more of a depression, because now that the fear is less, we're able to address the circumstances of what we perceive to be ahead, which is one way to get more excessive worrying in. But nevertheless, it is facing a reality that's now becoming a reality. At first, we had such high vaulted hopes that this would just come and go and it would just mutate and all that kind of stuff. Now we're reconciling ourselves. Uh-oh, we're in for something here.
Definitely, definitely. It's gonna be a different type of a lifestyle, which I don't think anybody really realized, but I think that it would really, like, socialization becomes completely a different lifestyle.
I call it the new abnormal.
Yeah. And then one thing that I noticed a lot is people who are living alone, in, you know, they're single and they're living alone and they're not like with roommates or anyone that they can be, also have a deeper level of depression. They really experience this type of aloneness, the isolation that they're going through. And then on the other side, let's say couples who used to not really be together a lot of hours due to work, now they have to be together all day with children at home. So like there's one extreme of the isolation and then the other extreme of everybody being in each other's face and space too long all the time, which is taking the stress on both sides a lot. And then they're obviously people who are very much getting closer to each other and enjoying the time of the relationship that they have, and they're really thankful, grateful for this time that they can actually be together and enjoy each other.
Yeah, these are, I live in a sleepy suburban community. We've had two murders, never happened before, ever, never had a murder in our town. And within the past month, we've had two murders of domestic violence. You know, it's, you're right. It can go either way. You can build a relationship on this and get closer, or you can destroy a relationship. So, you know, there's lots that's going on. The person that's isolated, of course, doesn't have the distractibility of being able to talk to someone, deflect. So they're really quite alone. And it just starts to play with your mind after a while.
So for all of the ones that we've talked about, and going from anxiety to depression and the whole struggle that people are going through, let's talk about mind talk, becoming more aware of the critical observer that we have inside. And then let's move into the four-step coaching that you have and offer in your book.
Well, mind talk is the way we talk to ourselves. Thoughts matter. I've always felt, and I tell my clients, that every thought, no matter how minuscule you may think it is, every thought has a chemical reaction in your brain. So a certain amount of neurons, maybe we'll never know how many, get changed by a negative thought, as do positive thoughts change chemistry. But it is not the one thought, but it is the cumulative effect of many of these thoughts that begin to affect us. So it is critically important, and that's why I introduced this concept of mind talk, to become more responsible, more aware, and more able to put our mind talk in such a sphere that we're able to generate the positive thinking that is necessary and embrace that thinking. You know, positive thinking is 50% of any problem, but the other part, the more important part, is embracing what you're telling yourself. So mind talk is a way of first getting in touch with the destructive child reflex, those past situations that are interfering and cannibalizing our thoughts, changing all that and putting it into a positive perspective, breaking old habits and initiating new ones, more adaptive habits. So that's the genesis of mind talk. And I developed a four-step program to accomplish that.
And you also shared this, that there are a couple of words that will change our lives when we're talking, when we're observing the way that we're thinking. There are themes that we could see ourselves actually thinking through. You know, if you do journaling, a lot of times you'll see how redundant we are with the same sentences keep showing up every day, you know. So the redundancy of those and the way that we've put those in patterns and they just keep coming up is very, very clear. And you say that some words are very, very important, that they can help us cope with any of the crises that show up, or whatever we create at that moment that creates the anxiety and depression. Just share more about that.
Well, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the two words of insecurity being the motor. Mm-hmm. And trying to understand what's prompting our thoughts, and control, and also asking, you know, what am I trying to control? If you're worrying, well, you're trying to control that fear. You're trying to anticipate what's coming around the corner before it comes around the corner, because then you can be raised, and then you can be braced, and then you can be ready. It's almost a superstitiousness to worrying. You know, if I don't worry about that dental appointment, I'm going to have my tooth pulled. You know, it's almost like worry protects us. You know, so there are many reasons why we try to protect ourselves. But when we get into mind talk, I just want to mention the first step, because it's pertinent to what we're saying. And that's to separate emotional fictions, that's the control insecurity thoughts, from facts. Now, that is just so critical, because if you think about what drives your emotions, the negative emotions that you feel will always be tethered to emotional fictions. I can't handle this. What do you mean you can't handle it? You feel that you can't. You see, feelings aren't necessarily facts, but our feelings tend to drive us. And when they are emotional fictions based on insecurity or control, then of course we're being driven. We're being driven. We're in the backseat. We're not behind the wheel.
So now let's talk about your four steps.
Okay.
One is observe yourself.
The first step is separating facts from emotional fictions. This requires a kind of dispassionate, depersonalized capacity to look at your thoughts and not judge them. See, what this step one is not about changing those thoughts. It's just recognizing what's a fact, what's a verifiable fact, and what's an emotional fiction. And once you're able to start saying that, well, for example, feelings aren't facts, once you say, well, I feel I can't, well, is that a fact or a fiction? Well, what if you succeed next week? Then you wouldn't have been a failure. So, you know, we have to challenge our feeling thoughts, those emotional fictions. Once you separate facts from fictions, it puts you in a place of choice. Now, you may not make the choice to say, well, that's an emotional fiction that's driving insecurity. I'm not going to go there. But at least knowing the difference positions you for what's ahead in step two, positions you to know you have a choice.
Which is also the detaching and depersonalization of your identity with that insecurity and what you call child reflexes, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Once, you know, it's like a court stenographer. You just record those thoughts and those feelings, make those separations. Don't get involved with them. This is purely an observational step to help you realize how often you're involved in feeling emotional fictions versus factual reality.
So first you kind of identify and distinguish between facts and reality. I mean, I'm sorry, facts in your own world and delusions, pretty much. The second one is depersonalize from them. This isn't about me, or what is it about me? And then kind of like remove yourself. And then the third one is stopping and neutralizing the progression of the ruminative thinking.
Yeah, the first step was the separating and observing. The second step is really a more of an action step. It's how to stop the runaway train of emotional thinking. For example, one technique that I use is called the ABC technique. We can't stop a neurotic thought from percolating into our mind. Let's call that the A thought. Then we say, for example, I might catch that virus. So that's the A thought. The B thought might be, well, what will happen to my family? The C thought will be, and then what's going to happen to my job? So the A thought we can't stop, but we then get into adding a B thought, a C thought. Those thoughts can be stopped. So realizing that they're emotional fictions, recognizing that you don't have to be passive. I call it active mind versus passive mind. A passive mind, you just let these old reflexes run amok. You just sit in that backseat and let insecurity steer your life. Active mind says, stop it, drop it. Now, there are various techniques I use. The ABC technique is just one. The third step, of course, is really being able to be responsive. I call it responsive living. But a squirrel run, if you get in your car and you say, what if a squirrel runs in front of my car? Should I hit the brake, turn the wheel? So you're getting all congested with what you should do. You're not trusting. The trusting person is able to say, you know what? I have good instincts. I'm a survival machine. Whatever happens, I'll deal with it. So responsive living is learning to develop the self-trust muscle. With self-trust, you don't have to anticipate life. You let life unfold because you're trusting that you'll handle what comes your way. And I always tell people, how many problems have you solved in your life? 100, 1,000, 10,000, 20,000, and you're here today. Somehow you find a way, either the front door, the back door, the side door, but you always find a way. Trust that. Start building that trust muscle, as opposed to the insecurity, which says, I can't.
And so the fourth step your first step is comes handy in your third step, which is defining and distinguishing between what it is that, you know, I have this delusional concept of I can't do versus all the facts that I've had of my strength and resiliency, tasks, skills that I've actually done through my years. And that can come forward so I can trust myself that I've done these things. Maybe I haven't done it here now with this scenario, but with the skill that takes for me to handle this scenario, I might have done in other scenarios. And that distinction could also help me bring those back in. And then your fourth one, reprogramming your brain based on this?
And the fourth one is the motivational one. It's really that unless you could sustain, one thing I just hope your listeners understand, you're not going to apply mind talk or any other talk in 10 minutes and really cure habits that have been around for maybe your whole life. This requires, I also talk about neuroplasticity, the changing of our plastic brain. In order to change your brain, you cannot expect that you're just going to hear some words or go to a guru and everything's going to change in your life. You have to practice. And my book is an attempt to offer people a format for what they need to practice every day. If you practice it, it's just like a piano. You're not going to play Mozart unless you realize the simple truth. You're going to have to practice. So if you have false illusions that you can just turn all this around willfully by doing nothing, you're not going to be changing your brain that way. Your brain will only change through repetitive, constructive action. And that's where mind talk comes in. And the fourth step of motivation is, unless you're motivated to go the distance, then why bother?
And to realize that the way that we found those loops had to do with repetition also. Exactly. So the loops did not get created with one time or two time. It got created because we over and over, we did the same thing. We said the same thing to ourselves. And we said, you know, we compulsively behaved a particular way. And that's how the loop got created, which imbalanced our chemicals. And the point is doing the new path of the four step, when you do it repeatedly, then that becomes the new loop, the habitual loop, and then, you know, manages your chemical aspects of your brain. Dr. Joe Luciani, Unlearning Anxiety and Depression, the four-step self-coaching program to reclaim your life. I wanted to ask you this because in your book, you talk a lot about the distinctions of psychology and coaching, and I've done that. 30 years that I've been a therapist, I've brought coaching and psychology side by side because I went to a lot of the coaching classes and the seminars, and I really saw them beneficial and I integrated them. And I really appreciated seeing that in your book also. Can you share how come you brought coaching into the system and you created self-coaching? You know, your other books about self-coaching was there. What was your reason for doing that?
I guess it was back in the 90s, early 90s. I was trying to help my cousin who was struggling with intense anxiety, had been on 5 medications. He called me Joey Boy. Joey Boy, you got to help me. So because he was my cousin, I would meet with him periodically. He'd come in and he would shake. He was so anxious. And he wanted me to cure him. He wanted magic. He wanted an abracadabra. But since he wasn't a client of mine, I was able to take off the shackles and really react to him. And I was able to be really me and direct and forceful. And I was like a football coach. And I would give him very direct feedback and stop this whining because you're just driving yourself further into your own impotence. Come on now. So I realized at that point that my form of coaching was what I had always experienced as an athlete. And this was years before all the other coaching movements. But I knew that motivation is getting someone inspired, getting them off the bench, getting them into the fight, and making them feel that they can go beyond their doubts. So the coaching aspect is critical because if you don't believe you can, you won't. If you believe you won't, you won't. So
it's all the directness of the four-step model that you have. You've brought that concept of, you know, kind of like cut the bullshit, really look at it, distinguish what's going on, and then look at what you need to do and take what's the fact, and it's right here. Shift your belief system, look at your strengths, look at the resiliency that you have, trust yourself in that way, and move forward, get yourself motivated to pass through all that is in front of you.
I have the three pillars. There's the cognitive behavioral part, there's the neuroplasticity part, and then I call it the motivational science, because I treat motivation as a social science, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to approach motivation in such a way that it is just an equal partner to neuroplasticity and cognitive psychology. So each of these three pillars are essential, to, at least in my practice.
Definitely. Last thing that you really want our listeners and viewers to hear from you that we haven't covered, but it's essential for them to know about what you want to share with them, or that is in your book, and you really want them to get this point.
Well, the essential point I would like people to know is that, and this comes from my own struggle, so I say this very sincerely, and that's that I threw out the concept of mental illness long ago, because to me, an illness is something you catch. It makes you a victim. I think the important thing is that I would like people to know you're not a victim. Victims are powerless. You are not powerless. So you can't be a victim if you accept the notion that I can do something about this. If you treat it as a habit, habits are learned, habits can be broken, all habits. So I would implore people to realize that as hopeless or desperate as you feel, once you start putting this into a habit paradigm, you begin to realize that there's a way out. And that way out is not rocket science. It's straightforward, understandable common sense once you know the denominators.
And if you could say one thing about what people are going through and taking your model, taking the four-step model and bringing it into what is going on at hand at this point, what would you suggest to people?
As I mentioned before, you are a survival machine. You have to trust. Risk trusting. It's a leap of faith, but risk trusting that you will handle what's ahead. If you don't do that, you will worry, you will stress, and you will run into anxiety or depression. Risk trusting that you're going to handle somehow. You don't have to know how in this moment, because you can't know right now in the moment, but take the leap of faith. Trust your resources. You'll handle it.
Beautiful. Dr. Joe Luciani, please go to selfcoaching.net, and purchase the book, Unlearning Anxiety and Depression, the 4-Step Self-Coaching Program to Reclaim Your Life. Thank you so much for being on my show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, take great care of yourself. Bye-bye.